Hey, welcome to another portion of .NET Conf. I'm pretty excited. F Sharp, seriously, you guys, I love F Sharp. It is like the CrossFit for programmers. Every F Sharper will tell you about F Sharp, and we have the best guys to tell you about F Sharp today. Thomas Petrasek, Isaac Abraham, and Don Syme, the F Sharp path to Data Scripting Nirvana. Can I say something? I looked at F Sharp many years ago, wrote this crappy thing, and Don Syme went to my blog and said, hey, this is great, fix this. And so that's my experience with the F-Sharp community. The guy who made the language is willing to tell me how to make it even better, and we're excited to have you guys.
Thank you so much, Seth. It's great to be at .NET Conf, and it's really a pleasure to have two speakers here for you today. We got Thomas and Isaac here to talk to you.
Cool.
Okay, so I'll do some intros. We've got Thomas. First, I'll just come and introduce who these people are. Thomas Petrasek, who's a board member of the F Sharp Software Foundation, which he'll be telling you about, and he's also a consultant for us at Microsoft Research, and he also has his own consultancy who he does with other F Sharpers called F Sharp Works, and he does training and all sorts of other things as well. And it's my pleasure to introduce Isaac Abraham. He's got this marvelous F Sharp Software Foundation t-shirt on. He's also an F Sharp MVP, and he works for a consultancy, which is well known to many in the Azure space, having contributed many of the demo systems, the top rate demo systems done for Azure over the years. And Isaac will be telling you about F Sharp and Azure and the great, exciting things that are happening in that space. So I give a very short segment at the start just to say, don't turn off, don't go over the other channel. This is what you will be learning today if you hang out here with Thomas and Isaac. And I'll just come a bit closer here. First of all, this is simple. This is level 100, level 200 talk. Where this is not, over the years, people have totally mischaracterized F-sharp sometimes as being somehow a complex thing. F-sharp is about simplicity. It's about beauty. It's about getting work done and focusing on solving problems and getting real impact in the world. And Thomas will be giving you some examples about that. So this is about F-sharp as a technology. It's about F-sharp as a community as well, about an ecosystem. Thomas will be telling you about that. You'll also be learning some basics, how to get started with F-Sharp projects and F-Sharp scripting in Visual Studio. Adopting F-Sharp in your enterprise is a very simple thing. Right-click, add F-Sharp project in Visual Studio, and you're off and running with F-Sharp in your enterprise. It's super simple to get started, and Thomas will be covering some of those basics. And then Thomas will be covering the magic of one of the most important F-sharp libraries, which is fsharp.data. In the spirit of where .NET and where Microsoft is headed, fsharp.data is a fully open source library. You can find it on GitHub and you can contribute to it. You can find it in NuGet. And Thomas will be covering that. It's a magical set of type providers and other data working utilities, which really enrich the F-sharp language to have data, as a first-class citizen, both in a type setting and in these common data formats that it understands in the type provider world. And then we'll be switching over to Isaac, who'll be telling you about some of the exciting things going on with F-sharp and Azure. We're telling you about a set of type providers you can use from F-sharp with your Azure storage assets. Your queues and your blobs and your tables, and he'll be giving you a demo of those. Those are beautiful type providers that really bring the data space of Azure alive in a way that no other language is able to do. And I really encourage you to take a close look at those and just think, wow, try to understand what's going on and understand how it can make your working with Azure simpler and more immediate from F-sharp. And then we'll be talking about another manifestation of that with F-sharp, which is about using a system called Embrace, which allows you to do F-sharp cloud scripting directly from Visual Studio. You can take an F-sharp computation, calling into a C-sharp library if you like. You can use F-sharp and Embrace to take your C-sharp code and pretty much any .NET 4 C-sharp code and spin it up over 10 machines, 100 machines on Azure, in just a couple of lines of scripting code directly from Visual Studio. You don't have to go into the sort of new cloud service sort of thing. You just spin up a cluster and use it as your sort of data compute slave workhorse directly from Visual Studio. And that's an emerging project, and it's one you can use today. It's, again, fully open source, and you can contribute to it today. And Isaac's going to be demoing some of that to us. And so we're going to kick off now on this exciting hour of F-Sharp, and over to you, Thomas.
Thanks for the introduction. So I'm actually going to start by talking about the F-Sharp Software Foundation, which is a recent development in the F-Sharp community. And we started this as a non-profit organization that's bringing together all the contributors to the F-Sharp ecosystem. And F-Sharp has been the pioneer of open source coming from Microsoft, because it has been open source for quite some time. It's been actually open source for, I think, a couple of years. Now it's accepting contributions as well into the core Visual Studio F-Sharp integration. But there's lots of other companies building around F-Sharp, including Xamarin. There's other consultancies and so on. There's lively open source community. So the purpose of the foundation was really to bring all these pieces together. So there's also fsharp.org website. I'm going to encourage everyone to have a look at fsharp.org. It's a lovely, we have a new lovely logo, but there's lots of useful content on the website, how to get started with F-Sharp, how to use it on different platforms. So if you're interested in F-Sharp, if you want to actually try some of the things that I'll be demoing, then that's the place to go. And let me actually, before I go to code, I'm a developer myself, so I'll obviously go to code as soon as I can, but there's really important thing that we need to say before, because when we are programming, we are usually in some business situation. Like, you're building a component that you need to build for your business, and there's lots of important things. You need to build a component that's correct. That's really the first thing. It needs to run fast, it needs to be efficient, and you also need to deliver the component in time. So that's the sort of business situation where we are coming from. And if you're in that sort of context, and I believe pretty much everyone here is in that sort of context, then functional first programming and F-Sharp has been pretty much designed to let you build your software that's correct, efficient, and build it in time. So the main reason for using F-Sharp is that it lets you build correct software that's efficient and lets you complete your task in time. I'm going to talk just briefly about two case studies, one case study. There's lots more that you can find on the fsharp.org website if you go to testimonials. There's lots of amazing ones, including one from the architecture space, where they're building a museum using fsharp. So have a look at that. The one I'm going to talk about is from the energy sector, and it's from Simon Cousins. And he says he wrote application to balance the national power generation schedule, and they wrote the calculation engine in fsharp. So that's the first important part here. You don't have to write the whole thing in F-Sharp, because F-Sharp integrates really well with C-Sharp. So what they have done is that they wrote the calculation engine in F-Sharp and then integrated that into the larger ecosystem. It's just a normal .NET library, and you can reference it from C-Sharp. It generates normal types that, if you're looking at the generated code, you don't see that it's coming from F-Sharp. And they use F-Sharp for the calculation engine to address the complexity of the core problem, of the core business logic. And Simon says that there was really a sweet spot for the functional first programming style, which was analysis of large data sets. So you're going to see some of that today. I'll start with small data sets, because I'm afraid. But then we'll have Isaac, who's much braver, and he'll show you how you can use F-Sharp for large data sets. Now, the most interesting thing that Simon is saying in his testimonial is that they deployed the application, and then Well, they sent the application for deployment, and then a week later, they still didn't hear anything from the DevOps people. So they checked, hey, have you actually deployed the application? Were there any issues with it? And the reason why they didn't hear back from them was that there actually was no bug in the deployed system. So that's going back to the correctness and how functional first programming makes it easier to get things right. I don't know if they found any bugs since he wrote the testimonial, but he also says that F-sharp is really the safe choice for this project because it gives you the safety that you wouldn't get with other languages and tools. So if you're looking at F-sharp, there's a couple of reasons to use it, but really the ones that matter are that it lets you get your system done in time, lets you implement efficient code and correct code that can handle the complexity that's in the business domain. And there's a book that we were planning called F-sharp Deep Dives. This is the first version of the cover, how you can profit from F-sharp. We actually couldn't use this version in the end, but it was a good try.
It would have been better.
It would be better, yes, exactly. So I'm going to go back to the code. So let's see if I can switch to Visual Studio here. And I actually want to show you how you can start. So I have Visual Studio with nothing open, and I'm going to create a new F-sharp tutorial project here. And tutorial 2 works well for me. When you do that, you'll get a script file, and we are also going to open F-sharp Interactive, which is where you can run your code interactively and see what it does. So I actually just want to show you how F-sharp can access all the standard libraries that you're familiar with. So I'm going to go slightly old school here and open system.windows.forms. And let's see if we can do a hello world message box. So I'll have to hello world. And I'm going to select the code and use Alt Enter, which evaluates the code in the F-sharp Interactive window, and here we have our hello world. So this is the two lines you can use to get started with F-sharp. I actually want to do something more complicated, and what I want to show you is how we can access some REST-based services. And again, I'm going to show you how you would start from scratch. So I'm going to go to NuGet, and I'll reference the F-sharp data package. F-sharp data, and here it is. So this is adding the package to my project, and I'm actually going to go back to my script file. So rather than building a project, I'm going to reference the package from the script file. And the best way to do this, I'm actually going to copy over a snippet because I don't remember the path and I don't want to bother you with that. So let me check where it is. All right, it's one level above. So here I just entered a reference. Now it's checking if I should enable the type provider, which obviously I should. And Alt-Enter will, again, define this in the F-sharp interactive context. So what I want to do now is I actually have one more snippet here with a URL. And this is a URL to a simple JSON-based service that I can use to get the weather. So the idea is I want to check whether the weather in London is nicer than the weather in Redmond. And the really simple thing we can use from F-sharp data is http.request. So if we put if we put London here, London, and I think I have to say in the UK, and I'm running this and running this, then what we get back, okay, let me call request string because that will just return the response. That's easier to use. Here we got some JSON back. So there's a lot of ways you can use to deal with JSON. You can use libraries like JSON.NET with F#, but here I want to show you the type providers. So I'm going to use the JSON type provider, and that's where you'll see the magic. So I'm going to take this path, and the way the type providers work is that they basically can look at some external data source and they generate type behind the scenes for you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the JSON type provider, and I'm going to put in some sample path like Redmond. And this will generate a type. And now I can say weather dot and get sample. Or actually, I'm going to use load here to load data for, and let's start with this path that I used before. So that's URL plus London, UK. And if we run this, you can see that it parsed the JSON, which is nice, but that's not really the main thing. The main thing is when I do dot now, I actually get auto-completion based on the generated type. So this is doing inference from the JSON sample that I provided earlier. And you can see what's there in the JSON. There's country, so we've got Great Britain. What we actually wanted is we wanted temperature, and you can just use your normal Visual Studio programming skills to find the temperature. I think that's under main. There's temperature. And I asked it to give me the number in Celsius degrees. So there's 7 outside in London. So that's one data point. And I'm going to wrap this piece of code into a reusable function, getTemp, that takes a city and runs this piece of code for the city we give it. And again, call it from F# Interactive. And now we can compare temperature in London with the temperature in Redmond. Redmond is unique enough that this will work. There's 9 in Redmond, 7 in London. So it's a bit colder here, but looks like we are pretty similar. Oh, Don wants to see the temperature in Sydney. Let's see if we can do that. Oh, -1. I don't know. Where's we need some nice place.
Sydney, Canada.
Oh, that could be.
All right, let's leave that out.
AU. We could have checked the country. Ah, that's much better. It tends to pick North America cities first. All right. So let me do a summary here. The main thing here is if you're a Visual Studio user, then F# is just another Visual Studio template. There's really nothing super fancy about it. Just open Visual Studio, go to new project, there's F# there. One thing you might want to do is install Visual F# Power Tools, and you could see when I was typing the code, I actually had pretty colors for all my types and such. There's also refactorings. This is coming from the Visual F# Power Tools extension. And that gives you things like refactoring, advanced colorization. So you'll need to install that. The other really useful thing is the REPL. That comes out of the box. Just go to View F-Sharp Interactive, and you can start using this for exploring libraries. The other thing that you can use really easily out of the box is the F-Sharp data package. I showed you how you can work with JSON, and you could see the fact that this sort of infers the structure behind the scene, gives you really nice types. That makes it super easy to work with JSON-based services. It also works for XML. We have the same kind of experience for CSV, and there's even an HTML type provider. One really important thing here is that this is not like XML literals in Visual Basic. It's very general, and the type providers are just libraries written by the community, and there's lots of them. So you'll see quite a few of them later on again. And really the key point is, this is easy. This thing that I showed you, that's something you can try and start using right now. I want to show you a bit more. So I'm going to do one more demo here. And for that, I'm going to use a solution I already opened, which is referencing an FSLab package. That's basically just the NuGet reference to get all the F-sharp libraries useful for data manipulation and data access. And aside from that, there's nothing magical. I just have a couple of comments here to tell me what I want to show you. So I'm going to start with one more type provider, and that's the World Bank data type provider. World Bank has amazing set of data sources, data and information about different countries in the world. And we can access all of this through DOT. So if I'm interested in some of the countries, I just see them in my IntelliSense. The way this works is that the type provider connects to the service, gets the list of countries. So Scotland didn't split from the UK, so it's not there. But if that ever happens, our type system can handle that. So I'm from Czech Republic, so let me tell you something about Czech Republic. For example, here we can actually, let's have a look at the capital city of Czech Republic. That's Prague. The interesting thing about the type provider is that it has all these indicators. And that's where it becomes really interesting, because you can, I don't know where this machine has page down, so I'm scrolling really slowly, but if I had page down, it would still take quite a lot of time. There's lots of interesting information here.
Wait, holy cow, it also gave you IntelliSense help descriptions.
Oh, that's right. It gives you IntelliSense help descriptions, so if you don't know what's generosity of all social protection, that's in percentage.
That's crazy.
This is again coming from the World Bank data source, because they have metadata about this as well. So I'm going to pick something simpler. I'm going to get from the indicators, I'm going to just pick population. And the type provider makes it really easy to get the one specific data point. So if I wanted to know this for the year 2000, then I could just run this, and there's, I think, 10 million people living in Czech Republic. So that's good. But what I want to do in this demo is to look at, compare the growth of population across the whole world. So I'm actually going to combine this with the JSON type provider to download the data about all the countries at once. So we've got our World Bank connection here, and I'm going to copy over one snippet that I wrote before, and this is using the service directly. So we are going to do HTTP request string as before, call the World Bank and get data for a specific indicator for a specified year. And this also supports paging, so we are going to get data for one particular page. So just to show you how this works, if we call the getPage function for the indicator code for the population for year 2010, let's pick the first page, and I need to change this to be the indicator code. So now we get back again, we just get back some JSON. So now we have JSON, we need type providers. So I'm going to define a type called WB using the JSON type provider. And there's two ways you can do this. You can generally either use a sample URL, which is what I'm doing here. If you're not comfortable putting in a URL, if you need to run it on a build server or something, you can put in a local file, or you can actually inline the JSON as well. So now we've got type called WB, and I can use this to parse the JSON that's coming from the World Bank. Let's do that. So here we've got, we didn't get JSON because I did something wrong. Oh, I'm calling load. Load will read the file. Parse is used when you actually have the data as string in memory. So now that's working much better. And if I do dot, you can see that there's the format that this uses is actually kind of weird. Let me scroll up here to show you what's happening. All the way to the top. So the format is that this is an array that contains two different things. One is a record with metadata, and the other is a nested array with all the data points. And the type provider is just trying to find the most clever and easier to use presentation for this. So it says, well, there's a record or an array. If you look in the record, you get things like total with the total number, I need to run this as well, with the total number of countries. If I do dot array, then this is a collection of objects. If I look at the first one, there's indicator, there's value and country. So the first country in our collection is actually an aggregate for the whole Arab world, and the population of the whole Arab world is this number. Interestingly, the value here is inferred as optional because this might be missing. So I'm going to copy over one more snippet. What this is doing is that it's downloading. I deleted more than I wanted. Let's do it again. I deleted the type provider definition, which I'm using in this snippet, but that's it. This is really just iterating over all the pages to download all the data. And I'm going to show you two little examples. So one is we get data for two years, for 2010 and 2000, and I'm just going to plot this for the year 2000. So we can see the obvious results here. There's lots of people living in China and India. There's not that many people living in, I think that this is actually doing interesting thing because it's loading the data lazily as well. So it will keep adding the other data as it finds them. There's some people living in Australia and so on. This wasn't very interesting because the population numbers are kind of obvious. But what I can do here is that I can calculate the growth. So And here I'm using the Deedle library for working with data frames and series. And I'm actually subtracting the whole, across the whole world, I'm subtracting the population to calculate the percentage. And if I show that, then you can see a lot more interesting numbers coming here, because you can see that there's quite a lot of growth in the population in Africa, but not so much in China and not so much in India. More in India than in China, but there's a lot more population growth in Africa. So, let me...
That was pretty cool.
Thanks.
I think the best part was like it returned a sum of something, and people don't realize that that makes it so that you don't have any null checking problems ever.
That's right, yeah. If I scroll back here, if I figure out how to do scrolling, then it knows that the value we are getting from the World Bank is option. And that tells me I have to handle the case where the value is missing, and we don't have population for all the countries. So that's where the safety is coming from. All right, so just to recap on this demo, there's lots of libraries in the F# space. I was using FSLab, which is a package that brings together all the data analytics tools. And again, if you want to play with F#, once you get the data, you can reference one of these charting libraries and do some visualization and charting. And all of the libraries I was using are actually open source. And that doesn't just mean that the code is on GitHub. It really means that there's active community around it. You can contribute to all of them. And when you send the pull request, you'll usually get really excited comments from people who are maintaining the libraries. So that's what open source really means to me. So there's amazing number of F# libraries and type providers. And Isaac is going to show you in a minute some of the libraries and type providers for working with Azure. Aside from all these nice F# libraries, and some of them work with C# as well, you can also use any of the standard .NET tools. So if you're familiar with any of the other .NET libraries, you can use them from F# just as well. All right, so that's enough from me. Passing the screen to Isaac, who will show you more about F# data and the cloud.
Thanks a lot, Thomas.
Hi. So I think Thomas gave you a really good overview just now of the sorts of environment and typical ways that you can interact using F# in Visual Studio. So the REPL and scripting data, as well as having to actually write console applications and Windows applications and so on. We dealt with some data that was local and some that we downloaded over HTTP. I want to now talk a bit about how we can use F# to actually burst out to the cloud as well, primarily in Azure. So one of the things that we get with Azure, which is really fantastic, is its ability to store data. You can store huge amounts of data, gigabytes and terabytes of files and so on. We can use tables that can expand as your requirements change and partition automatically for you. The best thing about F# though is the way that we can natively, within a script, talk to Azure, get some data and quickly start working with it using the same sorts of techniques that Thomas has shown you earlier. So I'm going to just illustrate a couple of type providers now, one for dealing with storage and one for dealing with tables. So with that, I'll start now in Visual Studio. So. So what I've got on the left here is the Server Explorer. Now I'm just using my local development emulator for Azure Storage, but this works exactly the same if you're using a live Azure Storage account. So if you're familiar with Azure, you'll know that you have blobs, queues, and tables. I'm not going to talk about queues today, but we'll talk about blobs and tables. So for example, with blobs, these are essentially, you can think of as a file system in the cloud. So you have a list of files, you store them in containers, almost like logical drives, and you can then read files and do things with them. So I can click on one, for example, called .NET Conf, and you'll see I have a file there called Alice in Wonderland, and then some folders with data inside it as well. So how can we get to this data from F#? Well, this is actually really, really easy. all I have to do is open up the storage type provider, which also, as Thomas has said, is open source, so anyone can use it and contribute to it. And then I'll connect to my local development account. If you're using a live storage account, you would connect here with your Azure storage name, and then you'd pass your key in. So what do we get with this? So first, I can hit Azure, and straight away, I get containers, queues, and tables. And when I hit containers, you'll see that the IntelliSense matches exactly what we just saw in the Server Explorer. And then if I go to .NET Conf, you'll see it's automatically going in real time to Azure and pulling down the list of files and folders. And I can just explore this by just hitting dot. So straight away now, you're in the middle of coding, you want to get a file from Azure, you don't have to leave your environment. You don't have to leave your coding area. You don't have to load another tool up. You can just hit dot, straight away get to a file. Another thing that's really useful is the fact that you'll find in Azure, if you start dealing with big data problems, as I often do, you might have a file that's several gigs or even terabytes in size. You want to look at it and do some exploratory analysis on maybe the first 10, 20 lines of it, maybe, just to see what it looks like. You don't want to have to download this entire file straight away. What we can do then is I can hit on this and get some simple information on a file. So I can hit download, which would download it locally to the file system, or I can simply say open as text. That will give me a stream back. What I can easily do now is simply say read line, and then just explore my data. So on the right you'll see now, we start seeing line by line as I call it. Now this is super useful if you just want to pull out part of a file, explore it, and then move on. What I'll also now show you very briefly is how we can interop between what we've just seen with Azure and going back to Thomas's demo earlier on and merging the two together. So I'm just going to switch back to the World Bank and quickly load up a bit of data that he'd put in already. So you'll see here, I've actually downloaded in advance all the JSON files that Thomas had mentioned before for all for population indicators. So I can simply get the year 2000 JSON, parse that, and get the 2010 data. And that's bringing it down from my Azure emulator, but this could just as easily be a real Azure account. And then with a couple of calculations, I can quickly do exactly the same charting that we've just seen before, except this time we're pulling it from Azure as opposed to from our local file system. Cool. I'll move on to tables now, which is a really nice feature with the type providers. So Azure tables are really useful because they're extremely cheap. You can really quickly expand on the amount of data. It will naturally shard out. You don't have to worry about running out of space, essentially. But it's also can be quite tricky to work with the standard Azure SDK because computationally it's somewhat constraining. You can do limited number of indexes. The query syntax is quite difficult to understand up front. So I'll just give you an example of how it looks like. So I've got a couple of tables here. Here are some soccer results from a while ago, and you can see we have a couple of keys and then some data in terms of integers and strings and dates and what have you. And we can easily get through to that, again, by hitting tables and then simply just exploring our table. So I can hit here and I can straight away see a few things. So I can get some data for a particular partition, for example. So I could say, get data for my soccer team. And we'll get a load of results. And if I then look at those results, you'll see, as per the other type providers we've seen, we immediately get IntelliSense for all of the properties. And they're strongly typed, so date understands it's a date time, and goals is an integer. This takes away a massive issue that you would normally have in terms of having to, A, understand exactly the types of data you're storing and make sure your C# or VB classes match. And secondly, there's no danger of me mistyping. So when I try and get a table called football results, it's impossible for me to get the wrong one.
And no more dictionary of string object.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Querying is especially easy. So what I've done is I've taken the JSON data set from that we saw earlier, and I've put that into a table as well. So I have all the years from 1990 up to 2010 for all the different countries and all the populations. Now, if you imagine that this had scaled out to be gigabytes of data, it might not be appropriate to load into the client, to your local machine, all of the data. So we might just want to do a quick query that filters out the data on the server side before it brings it back to us. And that's pretty easy as well. So with our population table that I've got here, I can do dot query. Now, if you've ever used table storage before, you've basically got two options in the native SDK, the standard SDK. One is with just putting in raw strings, things like where as a raw string and then make sure you get it right. Or B, you can use the iQueryable provider. But that can sometimes be a bit leaky because it doesn't, basically table storage doesn't support everything in iQueryable. So what we've done here is something which is quite nice in that it will only show us options that are available within the storage type, within the table type system. So I can say, get me all populations between 2 years. So I can say where year is greater than 1991, for example. And then I can continually change this, almost like Link would do. And I could say where year is less than or equal to 1993. And when I'm happy with that, I can simply say execute. And that will actually generate me a proper query. So if I just highlight a couple of lines here, we'll see this is what we'll send through. We'll say less than, equal to, and greater than. But this is all being taken care of for us. And you can point this to any table, and you'll immediately get this strongly typed query system. This is super useful if you want to go to your existing tables and immediately start querying them. So we get all our data back, and it happens pretty quickly. So with that, I'm going to switch back to the slides quickly. I'm now going to talk a little bit about the REPL in the cloud for a more computational thing. So what I've shown you so far is about accessing storage assets, accessing tables, working with your data. What I want to now show you is how we can also use this to burst out computational power and actually get some workload on your machine, send it to the cloud, do the work, and come back with the results. So with that, I'll just quickly go over to the browser. And I'll introduce you to the Embrace project, which is written by initially by the guys in Nessos in Greece. There's some really good stuff that they've been working on. It's now open source, so anyone can get to the project, contribute to it, modify it as they see fit. There's documentation on the website. It's just embrace.net with a dash. Really simple to use. Does show a couple of what the code samples looks like. So here we can do things where you have link style queries, so we have maps, filters, and so on. But this is actually all working in the cloud. So how do we get one of these Embrace clusters up and running? So for that, you can do it yourself, or there's a system already out there called Brisk. I'll just log in and show you how easy it is to create a cluster. So you'll see I already have a cluster here, four nodes. But if I want to create a new one, I simply hit Create New, and I can pick what type of cluster. In this case, it will be an Embrace cluster. I pick a name for the cluster, pick the location in Azure, which data center, so for me it would be North Europe. And then I just get a slider that says how big do you want your cluster to be. And I can just drag that all the way from 4 cores up to 256 cores. It takes typically around 8 to 10 minutes to spin up a cluster. Doesn't matter how big it is, it will take around the same time. So with that, back to Azure. So I've shown you now very briefly how we can spin up a cluster. And that there is this thing called Embrace, but how do we operate with it? How do we talk to it? So it's pretty simple, actually. This is something that you guys might have already seen, async. And if you use C# or VB, you'll know the async await paradigm, which actually was based off F# async workflows a while earlier. So the idea in F# at least is you write this async block, you put some code inside it, and then you can delegate that essentially to the thread pool, essentially, to do the work asynchronously. So what we have with Embrace is the same notion, but it's called cloud. Yeah, so essentially exactly the same, just a slightly different way of doing things. So what I'll just do quickly is show you how easy it is for me to interactively, in F# Interactive, connect to a cluster and start doing some simple work. So I have some configuration, and I'm going to connect to my cluster, and I'll just connect the logger up. I've now connected to my cluster. That's all I've had to do. And I can simply ask some questions, like show me the workers. So now it's asked me on the cluster the status of the workers, and I can see the CPU usage, how much memory there is, and what the network load is like. Very easy to do. Now I'll just illustrate briefly how we can take a normal computation and shift it into the cloud. So here's something where I've just done 2 plus 2, which is like a hello world essentially, and I get back 4. If I wanted to do this asynchronously in F#, I would wrap it in this async block. And then when I wanted to get the result, I would pipe that into this async run synchronously. Does exactly the same thing. If we want to now transport this to the cloud, it's exactly the same paradigm. I just essentially wrap it in cloud instead of async. And then instead of using async run synchronously, it's just cluster run. So when I do this, you'll see on the right suddenly now we see some logging showing that I've sent some work to the cloud. It's done the work. It's automatically bound up all the code that needs to be sent across. And then I've got my result back 4. This is like really easy that I'm on my machine doing some work. I decide I can't do it on my local machine because it's just too expensive. I send the work out, get the results, and I carry on. I can also do things like here I want to send 50 jobs at once. So I've said give me a list of 50. And then for each one, send a message out to the cloud saying you're job number 1 and the machine name. I can easily do that as well. And I just send it in parallel. Again, job gets sent out to the cluster. It will orchestrate the order in which the work needs to be done, automatically get all the results, collate them back together, and then give me the results. So now you can see here I get loads of results back, and the machine name changes for every single result because it's gone to a different machine for the entire set of workload. And we can even do things like link style, as I've shown you already. So here I say, right, I've got numbers 1 to 100, then map them by getting the square of them, then filter out any numbers that aren't over a certain size, and then count them up, whether they're odd or even. And again, I can do exactly the same thing. This is all just in my interactive console. I can explore some data, see what happens, don't have to worry about uploading software.
Question, does that partition it and run it in parallel?
Absolutely. So the question was, does this partition and run it in parallel? Absolutely. So it understands exactly where it can make efficiency gains by spreading it across the cluster and then get the results back and do a fork join pattern, essentially. And you can see I've got my results here, that I've got 24 even numbers and 25 odd numbers. So really, really easy. Doesn't really need a lot of work if you understand the notion of async work. Cloud is basically the same principle, except instead of delegating to the thread pool, you're just delegating to a cluster to do the work and give you the results back.
This is cool stuff.
Yeah, it's awesome. We're using it, having a lot of great success with it.
Well, but this is like crazy cool. I mean, I've heard of this kind of stuff, but wrapping cloud as if it was async, that's genius.
Yeah, it's just a very simple paradigm that if you're used to the notion of async work, cloud is just like the same thing, just give it to someone else to do the heavy lifting.
That's awesome.
Opens up all sorts of possibilities.
So can you guys take some questions, or is there a little bit more content?
No, absolutely. That was exactly where I was wrapping up. So
cool. Perfect. Douglas, here's a question from Douglas. He says, I see the advantages of F# for data analysis numerical tasks. What are the advantages to doing whole application development in F# as opposed to writing F# libraries? Where's the line?
I'll start answering, and then Thomas can interject as well. I think there are a number of opportunities where F# is more useful than just as a library. So, for example, the type system is a lot stronger in F# than other languages, so you catch bugs in your entire program flow a lot more easily. We're using it at ElastiCloud for our website backends as well, so web APIs, for example. Everything we get from JSON, we convert into F#. We have validation on all our messages. Everything is done entirely in F#. It actually works really, really well. Our bug rates have gone through the floor. Super easy to use.
Great. Another question is, how do you compare F# with the other data science languages like R and Python? What's the contrast, just to finish up?
So I guess the main thing there is that F# is sort of safer and checked. So like when I was doing the World Bank example, you mentioned that I get the data as option, and that prevents me from doing certain kinds of bugs. So F# is really safer. Compared to Python, F# is compiled, So the custom code you're writing is going to be more efficient. Python, when you want to run something really fast, you're basically either calling C libraries or you would have to write something in C. You also mentioned R, so I'll just have to say we have a type provider for R, and the type provider gives you access to all the R packages. You can just do R dot, and then you get all the useful packages from R without the quirkiness of the language. So.
Nice. All right. Well, can we get you guys full screen and on there just to finish up? We have tons of other questions, but we're sadly out of time. I'd love to get together with you guys and do a, hey, let's talk about F sharp, but with less, with more time. Let's get your screen. I want to see you guys full screen. Can you do that?
Can we do that? What do we do here? This one? No. Stop sharing. What do we press?
I'll just,
I'm not sure. Is that there is?
It's okay.
Did we? Right. The camera. Oh, yeah, you want to stop sharing. Let me try.
What do we do?
All right, we should stop sharing.
All right.
We know a lot more about F sharp than we know about users.
Yeah, apparently. Well, this is, I love this stuff, guys. We should do more on F sharp. Everyone's pretty excited about F sharp. I'm excited about it. I looked at it way when it was really young, and it's a good language. So we're going to take a little break, and we'll go on to the next session in a little bit. Stay tuned.
Yes. Thank you.